Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
A behavior, the way she'd act, like animals, for one. Finding a bird's nest and she killed two birds just straight across with stones, and I was crying my eyes out and she wasn't even asked. The mice that she had, that she just stamped on, wasn't normal behaviour. I was in tears and she was just laughing.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's talk about today's harrowing, horrific and twisted case. Twisted is a really good word to describe this, and you will understand that as I extrapolate the information. So let's go back to May 2019 on Greg House Road in the quiet area of Shire Green in South Yorkshire. I can tell you that the people of that area were literally broken by one of the most harrowing child abuse cases and murder cases in recent British history. Yes, that is how serious this case is. It literally changes the landscape of our understanding around child murder and the motivations behind it. Now, bear in mind, the perpetrators in this case are Sarah Barris and Brandon Makin. They are a mother and her half-brother. And I may as well tell you at this point, they were in an incestuous relationship. So when I said about twisted and sordid, that really does example what we're going to be talking about today. Also, this case is going to also raise serious concerns about child safeguarding and intervention from social services. And how many times do I talk about this on the channel? It just never seems to change, does it? Those lessons that are going to be learned never get learned. But let's talk about Sarah Barris and also her half-brother's childhood. So she was born in 1984. She was born in Sheffield in the UK. She had a troubled childhood. That is absolutely true. So she was raised in a home with five other children. They all had different dads, but there was no father figure within the home. And I'm not coming down hard and judging women who have multiple children with lots of different fathers. But I think when there is no engagement from any of those fathers, we can automatically assume the relationships did not have substance. And I do think you're making choices when you're bringing children into the world without a substantial relationship with a male figure because of the fact that they are important in the formation of children's experience and identity in the world. And of course, it's better not to have a dad who's utterly rubbish, but it is better to have a relationship with a father if they can, shall we say, maintain a decent standard of relationship with the child. And when that's denied, it can cause a whole heap of issues and abandonment levels where children are concerned. Now, outside viewers, they say that the mother in this case, who was bringing Sarah up, was struggling, but she was very caring. She obviously had had, as I said, multiple fathers to her kids who had no interest in raising them or even seeing them. And I would say there seems to have been a level of vulnerability around this particular woman. So aside from obviously having multiple relationships and lots of children with different men, there's literally no routine in the home. So the children don't have set meal times or bedtimes. They're not even expected to go to school. They're kind of just left to do their own thing. And again, on a developmental level, that can be pretty challenging because you need to help them with their milestones. You need to encourage them. You need to make those little things that they achieve seem massively important because it helps with their sense of self and confidence. And that doesn't seem to have played out. But nonetheless, in the home environment, at least they have a roof over their head. It isn't at that point too horrifically abusive. Now, Sarah Barras was described in those early years as being really kind and really caring towards her other siblings, but there was chaos in the home. And so after a period of time, the children are actually removed and she's put in the care system. And that can be unbelievably challenging because obviously it's a new environment. You haven't got primary caregivers there. It can feel really apersonal as opposed to like sensing compassion and care. It can just feel quite a cold and lonely environment for children. She then lacks a stable family environment from both her home, but also now in the system itself. And while she's living in care, Sarah would talk about the fact that she felt rejected, she felt isolated, she felt a lack of belongingness. And of course, she's going to have serious attachment issues because she isn't with a primary caregiver female mother, and she hasn't got a father who's come in to offer some kind of role modeling and make her feel safer in that respect. And now she's in the quite cold environment of being brought up in the care system. Now, she had previously made allegations of violence and sexual abuse during her time living at home. And I would say, having looked at this case, that that probably is likely to have happened. There was just something really problematic about the environment she was growing up in. And I think there would have been a very easy route for a paedophile to have got into the household and used the mother, who's very vulnerable, in a way which would have given access to the children. She actually talked about the fact that she'd endured sexual abuse from a really young age. Sarah.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Harris also talked about the fact that when she was growing up in the home, she basically would see these people as parental figures, but actually they were heavily involved with drugs or alcohol and other things that created a really unsafe space for her and her siblings. Now, those things have never been publicly corroborated. They certainly weren't connected to any legal proceedings, but it does go with this kind of territory. Now, it's around the age of 9 that Sarah's sent back home to live with her mum. So she, and at this point her older brother, who's a half-brother of 13 years of age, Brandon, they connect really intensely. They become really close. And one of the reasons for that will be that shared story, you know? The fact that they've been brought up in a painful environment, they've been separated from each other, and it's been a challenging landscape to overcome. Let's talk about Brandon, who's the other perpetrator in this case. Well, people who talked about him said that he was really not a nice character at all. He was a bully. He had very poor impulse control. He would be unable to control his aggressive tendencies. And this was both inside the home and outside the home. And there were so many stories of him just seeming to get great pleasure out of attacking his siblings or fighting with other kids on the streets. He did suffer from learning difficulties. So he had limited education. And this obviously impacts on things like future employment and personal development. And also just understanding the emotional landscape and vocabulary, because you need to be educated to a degree to understand how a word relates to a feeling. And that obviously hadn't happened for him. But it does, from the early onset, within his nature seems to be a sadistic quality. Now, bear in mind, he and Sarah are getting really close, and she goes from being this really sweet sibling, that's what was noted by her experiences prior to being around this guy, that she starts to look at him as a mentor. He's a little bit older, so he becomes this role model. Bear in mind, she's desperate for a father figure, and he's an older guy, so she kind of decides that he's the person she should model herself on. And whether it's an unconscious influence or a conscious influence regarding the traits that Brandon has on her, she starts to become more aggressive, more spiteful, more hateful. So this once kind, caring girl, she just morphs into Brandon's violent accomplice, and she seems very willing to walk in those shoes. And one of the things that she apparently really enjoyed doing was watching him inflict violence on the other children. She would just stand there giggling in enjoyment at what she would witness. And they were horrible things that she witnessed. So one of the things that her brother did was tied up one of her younger siblings named Martin upside down and then just repeatedly bashed his head into the floor. Also, Sarah takes on this behaviour. She caused serious injuries to one of her siblings by pushing her out of a tree, which could have killed her. And it's like they saw violence and control as intimacy. And they bonded over that together with this absolutely shared thrill of inflicting pain on others, inflicting violence on others, people they should have cared for. Now, there were reports at this point that the two were absolutely inseparable and they liked the same stuff. They liked horror movies, like dark themes. And of course, that isn't indicative of somebody with a dark mindset. We're all very interested who come to this channel in the darkness in life. And I'm sure it extends things like horror movies, but it feels like it means more for these two. Like there is a sense of embedding themselves in that kind of content because it exacerbates the feelings of sadism within. Now, the dark desires that they both held within them, they start becoming more and more notable when they start sharing an interest and enjoyment in torturing and killing animals. I kid you not. It always disturbs me because we always know where we're going with this. The MacDonald Triad clearly states that animal torture is one of the three parts of the triad that leads to seriously violent offending. Obviously, there is also bedwetting and there is also fire starting. But to me, I don't even think you need the triad. I genuinely believe that if you are killing animals as a young person, there is something really troubling about your psyche, and certainly the translation of harming animals to people has a strong connector. In fact, she would take mice, which were the family pets. Not that it would be okay if they were wild mice, but these are mice that have been brought into the household, which are pets, and she would literally stamp on them. Also, she would look for birds' nests, and then she would find the birds and stone them to death. So she knows that ultimately she's killing generations there because the eggs are in the actual nest and she's killing the birds that are going to the nest and she's getting great pleasure from doing it. And this is witnessed by a lot of people, including the siblings in the household, and they literally describe her personality as psychopathic. And I have to say, whilst we wouldn't say that about a child, we'd use something like conduct disorder, certainly killing animals has those hallmarks of developing into a psychopathic mindset and personality. Now, during the times of this behaviour, she and her siblings were still in and out of care because the home her mother provided was unstable. So again, a lot of destabilisation and dysfunction. Now, after 14 years of age, this is when she returned home. Once again, she goes to the police station. She speaks to them about the experiences of sexual abuse that she endured over many years and reporting multiple accounts from different people that had visited the home. So lots of different people had actually been abusing her. And one person did get marked as guilty and charged for rape. So it shows that she was being authentic. There was horror going on behind the scenes at her home when she was a child. And at least to some degree, she got a level of justice. But it's not as if this changes her into a compassionate, empathic human being who understands what it's like to be a victim. It's almost like it does the opposite, that she starts to really activate the toxicity within her nature. Now, Brandon, her half-brother at this point, is aged 18. She's only 14 years of age. And this relationship between them, it's really, really strange because it's over close when it comes down to a sibling relationship. And actually, it feels like they're starting to see each other more as romantic parties than they are as siblings. In fact, there were letters written between the two of them. And in those letters, they're talking about a romantic love for one another. So we have to appreciate that Sarah is probably going to have some distorted view of relationships because, of course, people have been allowed into her life who have sexually abused her. So we understand that distortion can be part of a victim profile. But she knows that this guy is her half-brother. And she knows that that's not normal, to be in a relationship with somebody who's actually blood related to you. Now, her mother, with respect to her mother, actually spoke to social services and said, look, there's something really weird here. First of all, these letters just don't really seem healthy. Also, there's an age gap between my son and my daughter of 4 years. He's 18, she's 14. Incest isn't legal. It's certainly not healthy either. But social services weren't interested. They took no further action or investigation into any of the concerns. Now, at the age of Sarah turning 16, despite the age difference, despite the incestuous relationship that would be if they got together, that's what happens. Their relationship turns sexual. And her brother impregnates her when she's 19. She goes ahead, gives birth to a boy, she names him Blake, but she does not tell anyone that it was her brother. She doesn't want anybody to know that he's the father. So she clearly knows this is wrong, frowned upon, and probably would have grounds for some kind of criminal punishment. Now, she talked to people around her and made excuses to the staff in the hospital, just basically saying, oh, this guy has got me pregnant. He doesn't want any involvement in the child's life. Now, bear in mind, she's been brought up with a mother who hasn't had any involvement from men anyway. Well, it's a story that's been told before and one that makes sense to her. But like I said, it shows you that she understood that there was a level of shame associated by having sex with a half-brother. Now, don't get me wrong, they're both quite manipulative as well. So they're not going to like be out there showing everybody that they're having a sexual relationship. Quite the contrary. They actually live separately. This means that Blake...
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Blake is being raised, as far as Blake is concerned, by a single mother without the presence of the person who is actually his father. But Brandon does frequently visit the home. He sees Sarah, he sees his son, but this is just all under the act of him being a loving uncle. Now, a few months later, she falls pregnant again with another boy. Again, we all know who the father is. It's Brandon. And that little boy is called Tristan. Now, over the next few years, I kid you not, she falls pregnant two more times. This means she's got four children under her responsibility, which is relatively overwhelming, let's be honest. Now, she did essentially pull off the none of the dads wants to be involved, none of them are present, pretty successfully. And this did hide the incestuous relationship effectively. But I suppose just because people are quite savvy, we are, aren't we? I think most of us have got a natural level of being suspicious. I mean, we all are suspicious. That's why you come to this channel, because we discuss these things. We're maybe a little bit more suspicious and paranoid at times than the general public. And so people look at them and think, yeah, they are brother and sister, but there just seems like something profoundly intense about their relationship. But no one actually acted on those suspicions. Nobody directly questioned them about it either. Now, as the children are growing up and they're more aware, understandably, the older boys, they're kind of saying, you know, why haven't we got a dad? Now, Sarah decides that she's going to lie in a way that I think is bizarre because this is very easy to find out. She says, oh, you don't have a dad because he died in World War II. Sorry? Yes, your father died in World War II. It's a rock solid lie. No one's ever going to know about it. Yeah, we're going to be studying World War II at school. Like, wasn't that a long way away? Like, wasn't it a long time ago? Didn't it happen many, 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 many years ago? Yes, I had a particular penchant for older men. All of your siblings have got dads who died in World War II. They were just very unlucky and equally very lucky because somehow I got in a time machine, I went back to World War II, I had sex on several occasions with different men, and that's why you exist. And there's absolutely no reason to question that story whatsoever. Kid looks just confused and wanders back into their room thinking, what did she just say? But that's what she's saying. It couldn't even be possible. Sarah Barris couldn't even come up with an excuse that was possible. Anyway, at this point, the kids are not old enough to understand. They kind of accept Brandon as this close uncle stroke father figure. Now, bear in mind, Sarah and Brandon are not working. They're both unemployed, and this means, of course, they are at home from the start of the day until the end of the day. And then Brandon will go home and he'll sleep the night there. One assumes that's to avoid people being suspicious of their relationship to the children, to the friends, to the family, etc. But most importantly, social services. So they kind of create this fabrication, which is meant to suggest that he's just his supportive role model when actually he's having sex with Sarah. Now, as a young adult, Sarah was described as someone who deeply feared losing people close to her and was fiercely protective of her children. Although, I'm going to be honest, this will be proved dangerously distorted down the line. But it does make sense that she has serious attachment and abandonment issues because she didn't have a father, and also her mother lost care of her and she went into the care system. And for secure attachment, we need to know that we've got a safe haven, that security exists, that we've got a foundation of support, and we usually need to have at least one primary caregiver who makes us feel loved and cared for. And that really hasn't been a part of her world. Now, bear in mind, as I've said, they have two children early on together when she's 19 and then just a few years later. And these are Tristan and Blake. Now, Blake, how to describe him? I mean, the children just all seem sweet, but he was kind of considered very compassionate, very kind. And in statements, people said he wore his heart on his sleeve. He made everyone around him feel loved. And he had this natural ability to just bring a smile to everyone's faces. Then his younger brother, Tristan, he was described as a typically mischievous little boy, but he was apparently really lovable, really adorable. He always wanted to stand out and he would constantly dye his hair different colours. He'd have it blue, he'd have it yellow, he even had a Mohican at school. And then he stated on a TV show that he dyed his hair that colour to raise awareness for cancer, because he knew somebody sadly who had bone cancer. And again, that just shows his compassionate nature, doesn't it? He was apparently brave, quite self-assured. Now, I don't have a lot of information about the other children because they were protected during the legal proceedings to respect their privacy, but there are younger children in the household. Now, allegedly, according to the investigation, the children were quite scared of their environment. They didn't feel that their childhood was normal and they didn't get to do normal activities like other kids. There were just an absence of these normal expectations children would have about family. Now we're getting to the point where Blake and Tristan are now in their teenage years. And at this point, Sarah and Brandon decide that they're going to have two more children. Both of those are boys. And this again raises quite a lot of suspicion from the outside. She just continues to say, oh, he's just a random man. I've hooked up with this guy. I keep hooking up with him. Then I get pregnant. Then he doesn't want the kids. So that is her excuse, that she is literally going back to the same guy because she obviously wants to seem distinct from her own mother who had relationships with lots of guys and children with lots of guys. She's trying to paint this picture of, yeah, I just go and hook up with this guy, get pregnant. It's like, I don't want to be involved with the kids. As if, you know, making the mistake once or twice was not enough. But again, most people will just buy into that. Now we get to 2018, it's November of that year. At this point, Sarah has called Child Social Services to basically say, look, I need help. I'm really struggling. In particular, she's struggling with Tristan. But both of the boys, so Blake and Tristan, have been diagnosed with autism. Now the others have been diagnosed with ADHD. Now I get it. There are some people in the UK who believe that close relations in families can still be together on a sexual level. I don't understand why first cousins are allowed to marry in the UK. Sorry if you're a first cousin, I'm offending you. It's not because I'm actively trying to offend you, it's because I'm trying to protect children. The statistics on children who are born to first cousins, when it comes down to mental developmental issues, when it comes down to physical deformity, etc., it's enormous. It's just enormous compared to a typical cohort of non-related individuals. So too, in this case, when you think about the fact we're dealing with a half-brother and half-sister, that is an incredibly close relationship, blood-wise and DNA-wise. So when you think about all the kids are being diagnosed with some issues, you have to think about them being born from an incest conception. Children from an incest conception question have a higher probability of having mental or physical disabilities because of genetic issues. Now, she is really concerned over Tristan's behavioural issues because the way he is obsessed around certain things that she finds really problematic. So it's not just him, it's not just Tristan, it's Blake as well. But Tristan in particular is really struggling with an obsession with pornography. So both the boys, of course, would access it on all the devices. I mean, you just have to put YouPorn in or YouJizz in. Sorry to say those words, guys. I didn't make those sites. But as somebody who's worked in this field and dealt with pornography addiction, I know them all. All you have to do is say that you're over 18. There's no actual need to put on ID that demonstrates you actually are over 18. You just have to agree. So it's really easy for kids to be able to access this on all their devices. And that's what was happening, even at school or at friends' houses. He's just watching pornography constantly. Now, with respect to Sarah Barra, she just tried to create some boundaries. So she removes the technology. She bans the actual sites on the devices. School banned them from accessing computers at school. They tried to help as well. And what social services say is, listen, have an open door policy in the home. That just means that, you know, you keep the doors open so that if you're walking past, you can see what your kids are getting up to. Now, Sarah also said that another problem that she was facing was they're starting to get really aggressive, particularly to the other siblings. And they're also in frequent fights at school and acts of violence at school. Blake once stole and drove his aunt's car. Obviously, twocking a family member is really, really negative where boundaries are concerned, because you don't take without an owner's consent anyway, but to actually do it to your aunt, where there's meant to be some kind of connected feeling. Also, Tristan, worryingly, was caught carrying a knife at school, and Blake was caught having sexually explicit conversations online with strangers. This is really worrying behaviour. Now, the behaviours like this, including also an obsession with horror and violent films, when you think about it, it kind of mirrors the childhood of the parents. So when you think about Sarah and Brandon, that's exactly what they used to do and how they spent their time. And you do have to wonder where this kind of behaviour is picked up and modelled. Now, after a social worker was assigned to the case, they visit the home and they actually said, listen, Sarah's trying her best to be a good mum. They said that as far as they were concerned, there was no underlying parental issue. Oh, how wrong they were, but never mind. And also that Sarah was not to blame for the boys' problems. This is after they've spent multiple visits at the home and they've had conversations with her and the children. Now, they were aware of the fact that every single day an uncle came round, but they genuinely didn't have any inclination of the darker truth sitting behind his presence. He was apparently relatively attentive. He'd take care of the children, so he'd do nappy changing, food shops, school runs, house chores. And according to court reports, he was actually a central figure in maintaining control over the children alongside Sarah. So together, they kind of were the people who created the discipline. Now, it is noted that Brandon was really attentive of Sarah's needs. So you think back to when they were in childhood together. She kind of revered him and idolised him. It feels like the tables turned in adulthood and now he just wanted to do her bidding. Whatever she needed, he wanted to provide. So he's the one even attending the meetings held by social services while Sarah stayed at home. Now, they also did some psychological assessments during the trial, by the way. And this described Brandon as someone who was easily influenced and deeply enmeshed with Sarah. Well, that goes without saying. They were having sex, and the brother and sister. Now, the relationship with social services, it lasts for a while, but they fail to recognise or even treat the true issues going on, and they don't really answer them.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Needs that the children have. Now, at this point, Tristan and Blake are attending school and they're now getting bullied. And apparently they're being frequently picked on by other kids. They came across as quite isolated. They didn't really integrate with the children. And then Tristan at one point is caught with a knife at school. So the concerns at this point were not that he was going to actively direct rage towards another student. It was that they might hurt himself or even kill himself. That was the worry. And he'd actually told his mother that he wanted to stab a knife through his heart. So again, just raising that idea that maybe he had suicidal ideation. Now, another report to social services was actually made from one of Brandon and Sarah's siblings, a guy called Martin. He said, listen, I have witnessed Brandon dragging one of the three-year-old children all the way down the hall in a really aggressive manner. Now, if you get a call as a social worker and you are told that somebody has witnessed a three-year-old child being violently dragged down the hall, and this particular person has no skin in the game, they just want to protect the child, the idea that social services can hear that and do nothing is mind-blowing. But nothing happened. Now, we get to early on in the year of 2019. At this point, Sarah raises concerns that she's having over inappropriate sexual behaviour between Tristan and Blake. This is towards a younger sibling. So apparently Blake's spying on a younger sibling in the shower. Sarah gets really concerned because she's starting to worry about the fact that maybe her experiences that she suffered in childhood are going to be played out on her other children by one of her own kids. And also, she's worried about Tristan because he's always asking the younger siblings to sit on his lap. And she's seeing that as a sexual inference as opposed to just an affectionate behaviour. Also, at school, there was reported that there'd been an issue between him and another student. Apparently, he touched her inappropriately in a bedroom, which again is out of order, but when we think about children's lives, if there are inappropriate sexual things happening around them, sometimes they become hypersexualized. Hypersexualized just basically means that their relationship with sex is very unhealthy because they've not been at a point in time and age which has been where they can understand the responsibility and accountability of any kind of intimate relationship. They're too young. So it forms this really unhealthy connection with sex that can translate to hypersexuality, which gets them in a lot of hot water because they didn't know it was wrong. Now, all of this is reported by Sarah to social services. She is basically screaming out for support, goes without saying. And she actually said to social services, I'm scared of raising monsters. So that reflects that she's aware that these issues could be down to what she experienced in her own childhood. But of course, she's trying to intervene. She wants some help. But she equally has this morbid belief that somehow this is going to lead to the boys being taken away from her. She had been through that as a child. She'd enjoyed it as a child. She hated it. And it had vastly impacted on her. She did not, above anything else, want her boys to go through that. Also, bear in mind, as she's saying all this, she's talking about an escalation in worsening behaviour. And in the end, social workers hold a meeting with just the two boys without her being present because they want to figure out, you know, what is going on? Now, at this point, Tristan's named as a child in need by social services. And this is when Sarah starts to really worry that actually her children might be taken away from her. Apparently, she'd speak to social workers and say, are you going to take my children away from me? Please don't take them away from me. But she's still the person who's calling the social workers seeking help in spite of those worries. So it's kind of a dichotomy. She really wants the help. She really wants the input. But at the same time, she fears the input and fears the help because she thinks it might result in her ending up losing her kids. Now, social services kind of start to get a little bit suspicious when they're questioning the nature of why no father's present for all the children. They start questioning this after a parent of another child at the schools reported Tristan for being sexually inappropriate with their child. At this point, Sarah's obviously defensive. She's obviously uncooperative because she's not actually got an answer, because the answer is going to get her into a lot of hot water. Now, one of the reasons they're asking these questions is just to figure out whether there is any kind of involvement of the paternal father, the biological father, because of the fact that they believe some sexual abuse could be playing out. So sexual abuse is a very common causer of hypersexuality. They're fitting into this paradigm. So they just want to check out whether any man has had access to the kids. And of course, she's hearing it in a different way. She's just very defensive about it, doesn't want to discuss it. So she refuses to state the father's name. She refuses to give answers as to why she won't tell them. And understandably, that concerns the social workers, because what has she got to hide? Now, because of the incident reported on Tristan about his sexually inappropriate behaviour with a friend, he gets named as a child in protection. Now, this means that he'll just basically be constantly monitored by social services, apparently. And this was meant to happen at home and at school, etc. Now, understandably for Sarah, who's already a bit paranoid and suspicious at this point, she starts panicking. She starts worrying that her incestuous relationship with her brother is going to be discovered. And at this point, the sadistic centre of her nature is revealed. Because, like I said, she's grown increasingly fearful her kids are going to get taken away. She believed that social services are going to remove them, and she doesn't want it. So at this point, there's almost this like collision of her panic and her sadistic capabilities. Because in text, literally, you can see as she escalates what she thinks needs to happen to resolve this issue. So she's sending Brandon texts warning him that they're going to be found out and saying that we have to do something about this. Also, there were texts that were found that she sent to a friend saying, I still feel like I failed Blake. I should lock me and my lock away so they can't hurt anyone. I want to die daily, to run away and hide from everyone. I love my kids too much to kill them. I can't put them into care for the same reasons. I've thought of every possible solution to this mess, putting them all in care, checking into the local nut house, or mass murder. Now, we've all been stressed. We've all dealt with situations that are challenging. We've all been in scenarios where really we wished that they would end. But we probably have never texted a friend saying, I don't know how to manage the kids. I'm thinking probably mass murder might be one of the ideas. What do you think? Should we have a bit of a brainstorm? Now, unfortunately, the friend didn't report that to the police, but you would imagine that the friend would think that she was just venting. She didn't mean any of it. But this is a big red flag. Typical people don't speak like this. Also, she made the weirdest Facebook posts. And they didn't essentially raise suspicion. Bear in mind, her friends knew that she loved horror movies and they always thought she was a good mum. But there's a quote from Stephen King. Murder is like a potato chip. You can't stop with just one. Very strange to have that on your Facebook. Also, she wrote, I'm not mean or cold-hearted. I'm just sick of being fucked over. And a third post is the image of the Grim Reaper saying, coming for you. And there's also more evidence of this darkness that's evolving in the text messages that she sends to Brandon, in which she states things like this. They need to die now. I'd rather kill them than kill myself and lose them to care. I gave them life and I can take it away. They need to die now. They need to die today. Now, again, the narcissism in that is just insane. This idea that because you give birth to something, you own it and you can choose when to destroy it is just ludicrous. But it is the voice of a family annihilator. Absolutely, we see that play out in those kind of crimes. But the fact that she's expressing this, people need to be taking her super seriously. Now, only if she was doing it in the direction of somewhere that could have actually helped would there have been any kind of resolve, because she's doing it to Brandon, and Brandon worships and idolizes her to a degree, and he's going to want to make things like that happen so that she's in a better place in some kind of macabre, bizarre, twisted way. Now, it's the same day of that text that I just read you that the tragic events occur. Now, bear in mind, this is because Sarah and Brandon don't want their secrets to be revealed and don't want their children to be removed. So it's so contradictory and ironic what I'm going to talk about, because you would think that they would do everything in their power to keep the children safe because they're so apparently desperate to have them stay with them as opposed to be removed. But that's not how this is going to play out. So they instead, in the weeks leading up to this particular day of the children dying, because that's what's going to happen, is that Sarah and Brandon are researching ways to kill them. So this is all found in the digital trail. They've got online searches on Sarah's phone, including topics like how to kill your children. Oh, how to kill your children. As if there's going to be like a, well, download this handy pamphlet on how to annihilate your kids, you know? But that's what she's doing. How to kill your children. And also the easiest way to poison someone. So very engaged in thinking about the demise of her kids. Now, on top of this is a high level of manipulation, because she's literally trying to sow the seeds with family members and friends that her kids are sick so that she can get away with murder. She's saying they've all come down with this terrible illness. She also asked for medication from a friend, saying that she was depressed and needed help. So she's thinking about how to actually carry out these killings. Then on the day before the attack, this is the 22nd, Sarah's been texting Brandon with these bizarre coded messages, which is all about how they're going to carry out the plan. One of the messages reads, "I've thought of a way to do it. It's quick and quiet. I'm sure they won't feel a thing." That's when she's talking about poisoning them, by the way. As if poison is just a walk in the park. I mean, everyone in the history of being poisoned is like, oh, it's fine. It's not a problem. You know, if they got through it after frothing at the mouth and having major, major fits. Aside from that, not a problem. Well, apart from the ones who actually died in that state that I've just described. Now, bear in mind, the kids are used to taking medication. They've got ADHD, and that's going to be really helpful, isn't it? Because now they can be convinced that they just need more of these drugs. Now, on the night of the 23rd, the statements don't state what happened to the two younger children in the situation. So we don't have the court reports to evidence that. But that night, the four older ones, including Blake and Tristan, they are literally forced by their parents to take as many pills as they could. So Sarah and Brandon crush them with water, and others are swallowed whole. Now, bear in mind, these children trust these adults. They might not be perfect adults, but they trust them. So when they're being told to take this medication, they are resistant, they are reluctant, and they're being told it's for worms, but they do agree to take it because the caregivers are saying it's necessary, but it's not going to harm you. Now, of course, they're trying to overdose them. Simple as that. Now, it fails because our bodies are very resilient, and often will reject tablets if we've force-fed them. But also, unless they are lethal as a cocktail, they're going to wake up. Now, Sarah goes and checks on the children. This is almost 6-7 hours later. She thinks they're going to be dead. And it turns out on the morning of the 24th, they aren't. All six of them are actually alive. Don't get me wrong, they're groggy, they're sick, they're disorientated from the overdose of drugs in the system. But, you know, they're alive. Now, at this point, she feels Tristan and Blake are too sick to go into school, but they were apparently well enough to play video games together. Now, these boys are just innocent of everything that's playing out. They have no idea what's happened or what's happening. All they know is they don't feel well. And whilst they're on their computer games, they have no idea of what's going to play out next, because what's going to play out next is their own mother and Brandon are going to kill them. They're going to finish the job because they're angry now. They're desperate because at the end of the day, these children are meant to be dead and they're still breathing. Now, for Brandon and Sarah, they went online again. They're looking at searches again of how to kill the kids. And in the end, the research concludes that probably the most effective would be strangulation. Can you imagine doing those searches? Your kids are sick because you OD'd them on drugs. They trust you. They're playing the game. And then you creep up behind them. You wrap the belt cord from your dressing gown around one of your children's throats. This is Tristan in particular at this moment in time. You do it as tight as possible. And he's begging for mercy. He's begging her to take it off his neck. He's begging her to save his life, a life she has decided to steal. He begs her not to kill him, begs her to stop. And Blake, the brother, he has to watch the life of his brother being taken away over a traumatizing 3-minute period. And he's also begging his mother, please stop, knowing exactly what's going to come next. Now, this is the moment, by the way, where the man, he doesn't actually know he's his own father, places his hands around his throat, does exactly the same that he just witnessed happen to his brother, strangling him to death. At this point, the parents place bin bags over the heads of their lifeless sons, and that's because they want to make sure that they can't take any last breaths. But it doesn't stop there. They decide that they're going to attempt to kill another of the siblings. They fill the bathtub with water, and they try to kill a child who was living under their roof, who was 12 years of age. Now, they made the same statement made by the two dead brothers lying in the other room. Why are you doing this to me? This 12-year-old is attempting desperately to keep their head above water. And we don't know why, but for unknown reasons, thankfully, this attempt failed. So the child did remain breathless. They'd been starved of oxygen. Yes, they were likely unconscious, but they lived. Now, it's at this point, whether it's a emotional realization, whether she's coming around from the chaos of what's just transpired, but all of a sudden, Sarah thinks to herself, I don't want to take the rap for this. I don't want to take the blame for killing my own children. I know. I'll blame Brandon. I'll get away with it myself. So she's going to do what so many killer couples have done in the history of killer couples. She's going to make herself seem like the victim because she's the female. It's an easier role to play, and he is the perpetrator. She herself could have been at risk from Brandon. So everybody has to feel sorry for her, right? Now, bear in mind, at this point, she grabs the other four children who were alive. She barricades herself in a room with them. And of course, this is all an act to make her seem like she needs protection from Brandon. The children are scared, terrified, stressed. They can't believe it. Two of them are old enough, by the way, to have an understanding of the situation. But all four of them are still dealing with the after effects of the overdose. Now, the next part of this woman's plan to get away with it is she notes things down on her phone. Brandon is the dad to all the kids. The pills didn't work, so he had me kill Tristan. He's killed Blake. I'm sat here with the others. He's going to kill them, then kill me. He's tried to drown the third child. It's not working. I'm so scared. If by some miracle my kids live, please look after them and let them know I love them. I mean, can you believe the deception of this woman? She's the one who actively was researching how to kill her kids and demanding it, basically. But now she's just going to project all the blame at Brandon. Then she texts her friend. He's trying to kill us. Tristan and Blake are already dead. So, of course, this friend immediately contacts the police and believes that that is what is transpiring. Now, 45 minutes after the receiving of that text, 15 police cars and 4 ambulances arrive at the scene, desperate to know what's happening, desperate to save the children if they can be saved. The local primary school shut down to use as a command base. The house is a crime scene. It's cordoned off. It's treated as a potential mass poisoning scene. And 6 children were found, 2 in critical condition, 4 with varying degrees of injuries. Now, when they get in the house, first of all, it's bizarre. Brandon is just relaxed on the sofa, drinking an energy drink. I don't know about you, but you know, if you've just gone and murdered 2 kids, what are you going to think about next, apart from going and grabbing yourself an energy drink, watching a bit of TV? Sarah, on the other hand, is barricaded in a room with 4 of the children. Obviously, her portrayal of, oh, I can't get away and escape, this guy's going to kill me, isn't going to look very positive in that situation, because he's just down, relaxing on the sofa. He's not hammering and kicking in the door. Now, emergency services said from the get-go, the environment wasn't sanitary, it was really cluttered, it was really chaotic, it was in a really poor condition. And again, that reinforces concerns to the emergency responders. They're not just dealing with some ordinary medical emergency, but something far more sinister. And my God, they are right. Now, with the police, bear in mind, momentarily unaware of the dead bodies of the 2 boys that lie in the next room with bin bags literally wrapped around their heads, Sarah is telling them that Tristan and Blake are at a neighbour's house. Now, again, this is really random, but probably she's trying to deflect her guilt and saying she doesn't really know what's happened, so that when they discover the children dead in the room, she can go, I didn't know. Now, of course, one of the children, just going to throw it out there, probably the 12-year-old who almost got drowned, they know what's happened to their brothers. And they very cleverly make a sign with their finger across their neck, pointing to the room where the brothers lay. Now, at this point, Sarah nudges that child and says, be quiet. But the police have got wise to it. They go into that room, and to their horror, they discover Blake and Tristan lying on the floor in the room. They then remove the bin bags from the heads, and unbelievably, guys, at this point, they're still alive. Now, they're barely breathing, but they're clinging on. But it doesn't last. They get them to Sheffield Children's Hospital, and at this point, they're both very quickly pronounced dead. Autopsies on the bodies of the boys confirmed that they died from ligature strangulation. They also had ingested tablets, but they hadn't ingested enough to be fatal. One of the boys also had bruising that was consistent with being forcibly held down. And the four surviving children, they all showed signs of drug intoxication and injuries, which obviously suggested attempted smothering and also drowning. Can you believe that these two individual adults, knowing that those children all came from them, were willing to literally annihilate them on every single level? They actually didn't harm themselves, they just harmed these innocent beings. Now, forensic teams, they spent several days combing the property. They collected a hell of a lot of evidence, so crushed pills, tablet blister packs found in the kitchen and bathroom, bin liners, clothing cords that had been used in the strangulation, also a handwritten suicide note expressing regret, but also trying to justify the murders as if there's any justification. I have murdered my child, but I'm justifying it because I didn't want social workers to actually take them away and give them a good life. So you killed your children so that they couldn't be protected. I did. I killed them so that they would not be protected by people and given a better life. So you went out of your way to fail to protect them, to prevent them from actually being protected. Now you say it like that, I'm starting to question my motives. Honestly, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Now, there's nowhere else to look. They're not sitting there going, oh, I wonder who's been involved in this crime. Clearly, Sarah and Brandon are immediately arrested under the suspicion of attempted murder. Two of the children taken to the hospital were deemed as unharmed, but the other two displayed the effects of an overdose. So when it came down to the court and trial, during the investigation, this would be the first time that it kind of came to light about the relationship between Sarah and Brandon. So all of a sudden, it's coming out that there is this incestuous relationship. But of course, Sarah's like, now I've been caught. I don't really care about my relationship with Brandon. What I'm going to do with Brandon is conveniently throw him under the bus. There's the bus. If you could just cross. Well, the bus is going really fast. Yes, just cross. Just cross now. It's going really fast. So if I cross, I'm going to get thrown under the bus. That's right. You've got it in one. So anyway, this is what she tries to do. Blame everything on him. Says he coerced me into doing this. He didn't want social services involved. He didn't want the world finding out about our relationship. It was all his decision. I was controlled by him. She basically said, I knew this was going to happen and I was going to sacrifice myself. I was going to take my own life after my children had been killed. Now, another thing that she does during the interview, so bear in mind, she's trying to say it's all Brandon's fault, is kind of makes her guilt a little bit on the obvious side, because basically the investigators are questioning about motives, why this has happened. And she's basically repeatedly saying, I would rather see my children dead than in the hands of social services. Now, don't get me wrong. I can appreciate that Sarah Barras obviously did not have a good time under the care of social services in the care system. And that is a sad failure on the part of social care. It happens all the time. Children have horrible experiences there. But the idea of thinking, what I'd rather do is kill them than prevent them living through those experiences, when as adults they'll have their whole life to potentially heal, is just warped and twisted. Now, the prosecutor, Carmen Melli QC, said they decided the children were better off dead than in care. Now, Brandon also, with respect, made a full-on honest confession of the truth during his investigation. He said the reason that he'd gone ahead and killed the boys was because of the reports of inappropriate sexual actions at home and at school from his sons. He said he literally wanted to, quote, rip their heads off and, quote, grab them and strangle the life out of them because of it. I mean, a bit rich coming from a guy 4 years older than his sister who was having sex incestuously with a mate. You know, when we're talking about sexual improper conduct, I just think you could have a few Blue Peter's badges of your own there, mate. Sorry, Blue Peter. I know that you don't give out badges for sexual misconduct, but you know where I'm going with this. Now, in the end, the police seized phones and digital devices that belonged to Sarah Barras and Brandon Makin. On these, what did they find, Sarah? Quite a lot of damning evidence in your direction, just throwing it out there. She obviously hadn't thought it through, had she? So there were Google searches like how to kill your children, poisoning kids, and ways to die without pain. I imagine that one was for her. Now, text messages that were exchanged between the two, they were discussing how they could carry out the plan and also what materials they needed. So they are 100% bang to rights, dead to rights, whichever way you look at it. Now, the Crown later uses this evidence to prove that the killings were absolutely 100% not impulsive. They were 100% premeditated. And during the investigation process, one of the children who was interviewed told the investigators the reason that his dad wasn't around was because he had died in World War II. Because clearly, Sarah Barras was in a relationship with a ghost. Honestly, that's the only way it could have been. I'm in a relationship. He's quite pale, and I only see him occasionally, and usually in the early hours of the morning. The witching hour in particular, because he's from World War II. Honestly, makes no sense whatsoever. The trial, you will be unsurprised, heard from the prosecution that there was no evidence of coercion from Brandon whatsoever. So, as I said, they've both been charged with murder. And then in September 2019, finally, they both admitted a full confession and pled guilty to the murder and attempted murder of their children. So it was two counts of murder, one count of attempted murder, six counts of conspiracy to murder. And this is good. Because, of course, if they'd gone not guilty throughout, it would have meant that a trial would have ensued, and that would have meant the surviving children would have had to testify, or if they were present at the trial, maybe hear information about their brother's deaths, because it always gets re-examined in court. So it's really positive that they chose not to put any family members through that re-traumatisation. Now, understandably, this case had blown up the UK and the courtroom was filled with investigators, with reporters, with family friends. The children were actually represented by court-appointed guardians. And when it came down to the judge's sentencing, well, they got life in prison. They also got a minimum of 35 years, which they absolutely deserve. I'm not really sure that they should ever walk the streets again, genuinely. I think there's something really warped about their mindsets, and 35 years, even though it's a long time, seems relatively lenient when you consider the seriousness of trying to murder six children. Now, this does mean when you add that up that they're not going to be eligible for parole until 2054. At this point, they're both going to be in their 70s, at least their early 70s, and that's if they get parole. Now, both Sarah and Brandon underwent psychological assessments when they were in custody. And guess what? They were deemed mentally fit to stand trial. They're twisted, they're warped, they're delusional to some degree, but they're not insane. Now, in court, Sarah expressed deep regret. She also had suicidal ideation, which means that she's constantly fixated on taking her own life, but she was found to have full awareness of her actions. Brandon, on the other hand, was described as more emotionally distant. He admitted to the killings, but he didn't really talk in interviews. So he just kind of accepted the guilt, but didn't have anything to say about it. When it came down to the Crown prosecutor, Carmen Melli, summing up, she said, "A chilling, calculated, and ultimately cowardly plan to end the lives of six children. Only by the grace of fate were four of them spared." Absolutely. She also said, "You considered your love for them and fear of being parted from them entitled you to take their lives as well as your own. These were horrific crimes. You intended to kill each and every one of your children. The enormity of your crimes is profoundly shocking." That's what Justice Goss said about them. Now, there was a statement read on behalf of the children's surviving relatives that said, "No sentence could ever reflect the damage done. Blake and Tristan were bright, loved boys with their whole lives ahead of them." And a family friend, a guy called Matthew Saunders, they commented outside court, "We watched those boys grow up. We had no idea what was happening behind closed doors." Now, South Yorkshire Police, they issued a statement praising the surviving children for their bravery, and they noted, "Their courage through the investigation and legal process has been extraordinary." And you won't be surprised to know that statements from the surviving siblings said they are terrified that they are going to turn out like their parents. And it's just so sad. And you never know, do you, who listens to this channel? We never know who comes across this channel. A lot of families do. And I just want to make it clear that the vast, 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 vast majority of children who are hideously abused and molested and neglected and emotionally manipulated, they turn in to the most compassionate, loving, caring human beings who would not harm a hair on the head of another human. I don't want those children to grow into adults fearing their potential, because the very fact they fear it means they won't become it. It's those that don't fear it, don't question it, do replicate it that we have to be concerned about. And they are rare. For the most part, those of you who've been abused listening to me now, you know that what happens is it makes you vulnerable to others harming you, because you don't want to do any harm to others. You want to please people, and that's detrimental to your own needs at times. It's so sad that those children carry the scars from their parents' actions, and they believe that somewhere intrinsically within them they may be bad. They are not bad. They are survivors. Imagine witnessing the murder. Imagine witnessing the horrific actions of your parents. Imagine finding out your father isn't somebody from World War II. It's your uncle that you've seen every single day. The trauma must be unbelievable. They said, "We want our mum and uncle to stay in prison for the next 300 years. Amen to that. So do I. Now, due to the extensive media coverage of this case, which absolutely, once again, are we going to say it? Once again, exampled the lack of help from social services, in spite of the fact that Sarah Barris was screaming for it, it ended up promoting conversations in Parliament about the oversight of children in high-risk households. Not that Parliament will do anything. Parliament and those within it are like the example of a chocolate teapot. They talk a lot of stuff. They do very little about it, because the truth is, them up there, they don't really care, do they, guys? Now, Sarah and Brandon's brother, Martin, the one who witnessed Brandon abusing one of the children, he said to the news that he absolutely knew that they were capable of murder, just not for their own children. When it came down to the community's reaction to this, well, first of all, the funeral that happened on the 8th of August, 2019, the community was in mourning. They were devastated. Loads of people contributed to funeral costs, because people are good and people care. And it takes a village to raise a child. And when we lose one, it takes a village to cradle them into death. The reality is, people showed an intense amount of solidarity and loads of support for the grieving family who remained. The funeral cortege was actually led by approximately 300 motorcyclists and two Lamborghini sports cars. And the reason for this is, well, one, these groups exist, don't they? You see it where kids have been horribly bullied or taken their own lives or have died of some horrible disease. And you get these great big motorcycle gangs, all these burly men on the whole wearing leather jackets on the Harley Davidsons. And they come to just show respect and also to show the softer side of a stereotype that people get wrong. And that in itself demonstrates the meaning these boys had. Yes, most were strangers to them, but all would have protected them had they been offered the opportunity. Hundreds of mourners attended the service. This included friends and family, community members, and so many wore colourful attire because they wanted to celebrate the boys' lives. The brothers, and this makes me feel so choked up, they shared a single white coffin engraved with their names. They were so close. They share in death what they shared in life, that really intimate connection. And as the coffin entered the chapel, Ed Sheeran's Thinking Out Loud played. Then it was followed by See You Again by Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth during the service. The ceremony concluded with Happier by Marshmello and Bastille. That was a song that their grieving siblings chose. Vicar Lisa Scott described Blake as a football enthusiast who wore his heart on his sleeve and always made people feel loved. She described Tristan as mischievous and lovable, known for his multicoloured hair and the ability to make others smile. And a family friend, Daniela Baines, shared, "Blake had a natural ability to make everyone smile, even if they were having a bad day. He cared about everyone. He had such a big heart. Tristan was brave and knew exactly who he was. He did what he wanted to do, no matter what anyone thought. And he loved to express himself through his clothes." Then the family friend, Matthew Saunders, said, "We are trying to make sense out of something that will never make sense." And finally, their cousin Storm emotionally stated, "I know this is a sad time, but in my heart, I will always remember my cousins. I know they will always be waiting for me at heaven's door." Without a doubt. Without a doubt, Tristan and Blake will have been received into the arms of angels and taken directly to heaven, where they will be experiencing bliss. But that does not deny the horror they experienced at the hands of the very people that should have been able to trust more than anyone else in the world. When we talk about the chain of causation and we look at the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune of our experiences in childhood, often we can see that we don't want to repeat patterns. I get that. But that's the irony here. When it came down to Sarah and Brandon, they knew the horror of an abusive childhood. And therefore, they should have wished above everything else to prevent children in their world that they created, albeit incestuously, ever experiencing horror. They should have wrapped them in love, in a sense of tranquil peace about their foundation of security, not decided that because some of their behaviour was problematic, probably because of the fact that we're incestuously born, that that meant that they should be killed to prevent them being protected by social care workers. It makes no sense whatsoever. Trauma definitely affects people in a negative way on a small statistical level, because we see that in violent offenders, most have been abused to some degree. But like I said, the vast majority of people who live in that situation, are brought up in that situation, who bear the burden of that past, they are the opposite of bad. But Sarah and Brandon are bad through and through. Simple as that. And statistically, people can be born into a world of really awful abuse and decide that as opposed to rejecting it, they'll take it on. And that's what this story is about. A chain of causation being two people with sadistic hearts playing out the most sadistic reality. As ever, this is absolutely dedicated to Tristan and Blake. Take care, everybody. See you again next time. Bye.